Blog Talk Radio.
There's information for 1075 box 412 is as follows. Daycare center, two-story, 120 by 120 class 1. Approximately 50 children after school hours, senior citizens on the second floor.
South Engine 11.
Engine 11.
We're still out here, a full still. We just had an explosion. We had an apartment that exploded. Traffic to Channel 2 at 1030, advised. 103 zero. Direct me location, Southend.
And Lilac.
Southend, we have a working fire out here.
Six Piper and Lilac for engine 7, engine 4, engine 2, engine 1, wind 7, wind 1, rescue 1, fire 103, medic 4.
Yeah, Battalion 1 to Main Emergency, give me a box. I'm going to set the stationary at Chicago Lakeshore Drive. I'll give you the stairwells in a minute, office. We have a fire up there.
Main to 271, 271.
271.
We have report of three people on the roof in need of rescue. Three people on the roof in need of rescue.
Three people on the roof in need of rescue. Message received.
Welcome to this edition of Taking It to the Streets, to your street, in your city, across the country, and around the world. Taking It to the Streets is a monthly radio show on firefighternetcast.com, and I'm your host, Christopher Naum. As always, a heartfelt welcome to our dedicated and loyal program listeners out there, and to our ever-expanding following of our newest live listeners and those downloading and listening to our program on their media devices. Taking It to the Streets is all about advancing firefighter safety and operational integrity for the fire service through provocative insights and dynamic discussions dedicated to the art and science of firefighting and, more importantly, to the traditions of the fire service. I'm glad to be your host tonight on this edition of Taking It to the Streets. We've got an exceptional program, as we always, for our listeners. Accompanying me tonight are certainly my two esteemed colleagues. I've got Joe Prenesti from Ohio on, and John Mitchell, our executive producer, and also the producer on, I'll say, Diamond Plate Productions, firefighternetcast.com, and also the editor of firedaily.com. So welcome, gentlemen. How are you guys doing tonight?
Hi, Chris. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Very good. Joe, always a pleasure to have you on, and John, thanks again for an exceptional activity here for getting us up and going. So with that being said, our program tonight on Taking It to the Streets is Buffalo, Bronx, and Basement Ops. Joe, you and I have been talking over the last couple of weeks, and many of our listeners can, for those that have either downloaded or listened live, we certainly had an exceptional program a couple of weeks ago when we talked about the FDNY wall bombs fire in Brooklyn, New York in 1978 with two of our esteemed guests with Jerry Tracy and certainly talking about some items with Chief Vinnie Dunn at that particular time. Joe, you know, this whole month here, in the month of August, when we take a look at line of duty deaths and the events that have occurred, there's certainly a number of incidences that, again, resonate each and every week throughout the entire month, that we have lessons from the fire ground that we can certainly talk about, discuss, and more importantly, learn from them. So you and I talked a little bit about tonight's program, which led us to the topical item. We have two events that we'll be discussing to sort of bookend and lead us into our discussion on basements and operations and, more importantly, some of the issues affecting buildings on fire within these particular building types. But I'll make mention of those two in general, and Joe, you can sort of lead in from there, but we'll be talking about two events that occurred in New York State, one which occurred in 2006 and the other in 2009. The 2006 event that we're referring to occurred in FDNY in the borough of the Bronx on August 27th, 2006, in which two firefighters lost their lives in a Class 3 structure, which resulted in a floor collapse and during the course of fire suppression operations. The second event, which occurred on August 24th, 2009, also resulted in a double line of duty death, and that occurred in the city of Buffalo, New York, in the western part of New York State. And again, a early morning fire in this particular event, type 3 structure, and again, a partial compromise and collapse of the basement, and then followed certainly in both cases with maydays and subsequent fast team deployments and operations. And both of these, again, were both engaged during fire suppression activities as well as during initial search and rescue efforts. So, Joe, what can we talk about regarding these two events that resonate in terms of the importance and our understanding of operations and some of the high points of these lessons from the fire grounds that we constantly try to get out in front of our listeners and our audiences as we teach around the country?
Well, I think the biggest thing with the Buffalo, New York one is that it's one of the first line of duty deaths where I think you can, there's enough, whether it's from the report that was done from the department or the NIOSH report, but the audio which was released, that between that and the raw video and the reports, that you can put together a very effective, I don't want to call it a critique, but a lesson about what took place, and you can apply it to your buildings and things that you have in your town, and it paints a picture, and that is what's so the importance of the lessons is that you're able to put the pieces together. And a lot of line of duty deaths, I think that the reports, while effective, they don't always put everything together for you like they should. In this event, utilizing the audio and the raw video from the scene and the report, those are three great pieces that it makes it very simple to figure out what transpired and how you can improve your own through the lessons, through the sacrifice of those two brothers, Jonathan Kroom and Chip McCarthy.
Yeah, when we talk about the Buffalo New York Fire Department's response, again, we're talking about a structure, type 3, class 3, brick and joist construction for our listeners. Again, are approximately 2,500 square feet, two-story. Mixed occupancy in terms of a typical type of multiple occupancy apartment units, both occupied and unoccupied. A first floor bodega or delicatessen, and then obviously a basement occupancy that contributed significantly to the building's performance and obviously contributed significantly to the compromising conditions. And we talk about Lieutenant Chip McCarthy, and we talk about Jonathan Kroom, who was deployed on the during the May Day and the fast deployment. Two very separate phases of our operations, but again, in this particular incident in Buffalo in 2009, we're dealing with a very traditional-based operation. And by traditional, I'm referring to the classical modeling of arrival of our companies, deployment relative to our tactical operations, search and rescue, engine company deployment for the tactical operations, ventilation. I mean, again, our traditional elements of fire ground management operations from the tactical standpoint in a pretty innocuous structure. Nothing extraordinary about it other than the fact that it was located in a sizable metropolitan urban setting. And when we talk about the similar structure in the Bronx, we are also referring to a building of type 3 construction, brick and joist, basement occupancy condition with limited access, similar to what we had in Buffalo. But again, a similar structure in terms of size. The fire in FDNY in the Bronx that we're referring to, again, from the May 27, 2006, this was approximately 3,000 square feet in size. More commonly a commercial mixed occupancy usage from that standpoint, but some very common elements here as we go through them. And again, we did mention, again, part of our discussion here tonight on this episode of Taking It to the Streets is not so much to critique these two events. We want to certainly honor and have the remembrance of our brothers who lost their lives in these two particular structures. We want to utilize these events to encourage our listeners to go to the reference material that we have on our website. If you go to firegroundleadership.com, we do have a wealth of information specific to our posting on Monday, which deals with the Buffalo, New York, Genesee Street fire, as it's referred to, and again, with some insights and the lessons from the fireground that we are referring to. But more importantly, there are two reports there, the after-action report, line-of-duty death report that the City of Buffalo Fire Department published in the latter part of that year in 2009, as well as the NIOSH report, which is F2009-23 for the Buffalo, and then our FDNY of our report is under the NIOSH of F2006-27. So again, we do have a variety of informational items to provide some further insight for our listeners to gain some understanding on three factors: the buildings and their associated predictability of performance, and factors that, again, when we talk about type 3 construction, also the firefighting operations that ensued in both events, and then, again, the lessons to be learned based upon the outcome of those tactical deployments and operations. So, again, the learnings to honor our brothers, both for Lieutenant Charles Chip McCarthy, Firefighter Jonathan Kroom from the Buffalo, New York Fire Department, and certainly when we talk about FDNY and the incident from 2006, August 27th of 2006, and our honor and remembrance for Lieutenant Howard Karpluck from Engine 42 in the Bronx and Firefighter Michael Riley of Engine 75, who, again, operated at 1575 Walton Ave for that particular event. So with that being said, Joe, why don't you lead us through some of the particulars starting off with our Buffalo event and sort of lead us into a little bit of our discussion on the Bronx also.
Well, as far as the Buffalo, you know, both of these events, I wanted to digress a little bit. Both of these events had multiple dominoes that collapsed, for no better term here. But they both have, and they both also teach us multiple lessons. In Buffalo especially, there are things that you can take and give to your dispatch, because their dispatch played a role in this event, nothing negatively, but when you're talking maydays, do you have faith and confidence in your dispatch centers? Have you trained with them? Do they know how to handle a mayday? You know, there were several PARs that were taken. They call them emergency headcounts, that the dispatch center had to run. And some of the issues that were noted in the NIOSH and in the internal report were based on accountability and lack of accountability. And they had a member missing in Buffalo and they didn't know it. So we'll start off by, you described the buildings. And in Buffalo, they were called for a fire with reported people trapped in the basement. And again, like you described, it was a bodega. And in a lot of these types of stores. It's type 3, where you have a storefront on the first floor, apartments on the second and third floor. It's not unusual for the store owners or the workers to spend the night or to live there. And so the dispatch, and we'll have John play it up here in a second, but the dispatch noted that there were reported people trapped. And who stated that? I'm not really sure it ever really went in depth as to who stated that. It turned out that no one was trapped, but all of us as firefighters, when we hear that people are trapped, it raises your antenna and it raises your levels big time, especially in the middle of the night. So we'll start off with the dispatch. And John, if you could cue up the initial dispatch of the event, our listeners can begin to paint the picture.
An alarm of fire, number 1815 Genesee between Burgard and Bailey. That's go for engine 31, 22, 23, ladder 14, ladder 6. Ladder 7 responds to fast team, rescue 1, F20, F9, and B43. An alarm of fire, number 1815 Genesee between Burgard and Bailey. That's go for engine 31, 22, 23, ladder 14, ladder 6. Ladder 7 responds to fast team, rescue 1, F20, F9, and B43. This structure is also reported to be occupied. The occupants are reported to be still inside. All companies respond on channel 2. Your timeout is 350 hours, Buffalo Fire.
31 going. Smoke showing from quarters.
31 is responding. Smoke showing from quarters. I want to be aware of the fact we got a couple phone calls. Second phone call indicated that structure is occupied. The occupants are reported to be still inside.
4-3 going.
31 location. We got smoke showing.
4-3 is responding. 1815 Genesee, 31 is on location reporting smoke showing.
Okay, John. 31 is
dispatch.
Got people trapped.
It's clear, 31 reporting people trapped.
Okay, so pretty much every firefighter listening to this, whenever we've heard that, boy, I tell you, it gets your heart pumping. And so they had our number one is life safety. That is our first and foremost job as firefighters. So, you know, they knew they had people trapped, and they arrived. They had smoke showing from quarters, so they knew they were going to a worker. They had smoke showing. They had people trapped. So all of these things put together a serious event, and they then had trouble getting into the building. There were steel bars, heavily fortified building. It was heavily secured. They couldn't get in. And there was also reports that they could hear people or something banging on the door. Again, in the report, it was never substantiated. They did not find any bodies in the rubble or in the fire, any civilians, I should say. And but they were stating they could hear this. So, you know, you have a middle of the night. It's all about putting the pieces together. Middle of the night. You have to think delayed alarm. You have a good fire. You can see the smoke from quarters. You know, unless you're right across the street, this was a few blocks away from their house, engine 31, but you have to put the pieces together. Then it was taking a long time for forceful entry. So there's another issue that, okay, this fire is progressing. You're not getting any water on it because it's taking a lot of time. So all these things began to add up, Chris, and I'll let you go ahead and add anything up to this point, but that is the initial synopsis, I should say.
And again, it's important for our listeners to understand, you know, again, we're talking about a type 3 structure, brick and joist, very common, whether we talk about, and I alluded to this during my earlier remarks, whether we talk about these occupancies and structures in the urban metro settings or within the crossroads of a village or community anywhere across the country. Their performance is dictated by their unique inherent characteristics. In other words, the types of the manner in which the floor systems are constructed, their age and vintage. The Buffalo event that we're referring to right now was built approximately in 1934, again, consisting typically of our wood floor, masonry, brick bearing wall construction, two stories, mixed occupancy. So very common when we talk about this particular type of structure as a freestanding unit on a lot, that should relate to our listeners, again, whether we talk about being present in the Corn Belt of the United States or any one of our urban or suburban areas. These are as common as they can be in the majority of our areas around the country, and certainly their performance when we talk about the precursors to potential collapse and their predictability of performance is driven by the effectiveness of both the size up as well as maintaining the continuity of the conditions throughout the course of that operations. Now, in this particular event, the May Day occurs approximately 30 minutes into the operation. And the one thing, Joe, you know, you made mention of that they knew that they had trapped victims and so forth. But again, let's just refocus our attention. Well, after the fact, we identified that under all of the conditions, there was never anything validated of any occupants being either present or certainly being in a stage of distress. But as the companies are being dispatched, as they're rolling out of quarters and responding off of the pad, they have smoke on the horizon, they've got the loom up, and all of these things are starting to put into motion our typical line of events in terms of our response, our thought processes, what we anticipate based upon our experience, what our dashboard indicators are telling us both visually as well as our other sensory items of what we're listening to in terms of radio communication. So all these communications that still had not been substantiated are indicating both the caller, the dispatch, and the responding unit's presumptions upon arrival, especially with the condition showing. Heavy smoke, definitely a working fire, deep-seated, type 3 occupancy, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, what do we normally assume? How do we go quickly into a mobilized direction strategically and tactically? So the companies did exactly as they've been trained to do, as all of us have been programmed in terms of how we think and how we manage and administer ourselves on the fire ground. But as that operation unfolded, very little is really documented aside from some of the particulars that we just mentioned, the type 3 nature of the building. And, Joe, you made mention of the heavy fortified nature. This particular structure, as was the fire in the Bronx at FDNY, limited access, the Bronx event, had only one way in, and that was from the exterior of the structure, through a scuttle opening, no direct access from the interior on the Walton Ave fire. And this, too, when we talk about the event and at Buffalo on Genesee Street, had an outside access, which was, restricted in terms of the engine company being able to apply water immediately in a timely fashion, which caused some delays and obviously allowed other conditions to propagate and affect the building. So the one thing is that's a takeaway here for our listeners is that as we are operating, especially in these particular structures, with a basement fire or a condition within any of the compartments, that the structural assembly, the floor system, the ceiling, the roof rafters are all highly susceptible to fire extension and fire impingement, both in terms of products as well as direct flame impingement, and that the potential for compromise and, more importantly, for collapse to occur is a given. It's not a matter of if it's going to occur. It's just a matter of when, and there has to be a very heightened sense of fire ground monitoring, both from a command standpoint as well as from a divisional and various areas around the structure to be monitoring those conditions. So certainly, well, yeah, go ahead, John.
I was just going to say that, you know, one of the things that really I think a lot of fire departments utilize
And it's like any other. You can get complacent. You can get repetitive. Is that Buffalo Fire does an excellent job of giving 20-minute updates, 10-minute updates, what have you. And so their dispatch will call their command officer and say, this is your 20-minute, you're 20 minutes into the incident. And that is not to be able to talk on a radio, but that is to allow the commander to, okay, this is what I have. Thank you. I'm 20 minutes in. It's a kick in the pants. It's a shake, if you will, that, okay, what do you got going on? Refocus. And I think when you continue to, go to room and contents, fires, and I'm talking anywhere, not just in this particular case. In my department, we do 20-minute updates. Well, if you're going to room and contents, fires, usually in 20 minutes, you get one update and you tell dispatch to stop because it's over. Or, it's very, okay, we're overhauling now. The danger has diminished. But in this particular case, and I'll let John play it up, the 20-minute update still paints a story that can help you as a command officer say, you know what, these updates are important. Or I need to refocus, and I need to look at it. And the old rule in these types of buildings was 20 minutes. Okay, 20 minutes, you haven't suppressed the fire, or you haven't gotten control of it, you better think about pulling out. And although that's not what we want to go by now in today's fire environment, that was always the old rule. And so I'll let John play up. This is 20 minutes in. I'll let our listeners hear, but this is the 20-minute update, dispatch calling command. Go ahead, John.
Man, just so you know, you're at 20 minutes in the incident.
That's clear. 20 minutes into 1815 Genesee Street, two-story ordinary. We're now operating 3-3/4 lines. We're doing an aggressive interior search. We still have a report of civilians trapped. We believe they may be in the basement. We're going to hold everybody we have, including 2-1.
R1, this is 4-3.
That's clear, command. Aggressive interior search with 3-3/4 lines in use. Do you believe the occupants might be in the basement?
Okay, John. So right there, 20 minutes in, I doubt conditions that they had, that even if there were people there, I'm going to just say it would be very, very difficult for survivability. We've talked about survivability profiling and other podcasts and other classes, and, each circumstance is different. But we have to take a step back and look at the building and take a survivability profile, not only of victims that might be inside, but the building. And that was those few seconds on the air there, the radio report, they're pretty telling on, refocusing and really thinking about what is going on. And this is a good example and a good lesson for ICs to, when they're called 20 minutes in even in their own head, to reevaluate the building at all times, constantly. And the survivability, again, of the building and the victims that might be inside.
Well, you make a great point, Joe. When we talk about, and again, when we talk about the media clip that we just listened to, just spot on when we talk about the information that is value added. We have good critical information that's pertinent that the incident commander is providing. It's acknowledged by the communications center. It was concise as to what was occurring, conditions, factors, and implications that they had relative to that. And again, going on the presumption that, again, they had unidentified and unlocated civilians, all based upon the premise of the initial dispatch. But the point that you're making, Joe, and that we constantly try to instill upon our students is that, although we are monitoring our tactical objectives and tactical progress, there's certainly, again, and especially with today's modern fireground, and the fact that we are talking about a very old type of structure that is highly susceptible to compromised and collapsed that we have to be monitoring the building's deterioration. The fact that as the developing and progressing fire conditions in whatever the compartment may be, in this instance, the compartment is the basement, whether it be on the number two, number three floor, up in the truss loft, cock loft areas and so forth, any of the concealed locations, that if we do have progressing fire of any type and any severity of magnitude, that it will affect these particular building types, a type three building, very pronouncedly. And it will affect it in a manner that may catch us off guard based upon what we are presuming the integrity may have been under past conditions. In other words, you know, when we refer back to the FDNY Bronx fire on Walton Ave, that particular structure, which ended up, again, we have a floor collapse. The floor ends up collapsing in a V-shaped condition in which a number of our firefighters that are operating on the number one floor end up collapsing into this V pattern as the floor gives way. But the report, subsequent reports identified that there were significant age deterioration that had occurred within those joists, that the vertical timber supports also had significant structural deficiencies due to age. And then more importantly, as we have seen in numerous instances, certainly within the metropolitan New York City area, the building had modifications that were not compliant with the codes in that were in effect at that time in 2006. So we have building modifications and conditions. We have age factors and deterioration, as well as the inherent characteristics of the building themselves. Bearing wall construction, pocketed floor joists that, again, over the span of their longevity have lost their either load-bearing capacity, or we've increased significantly the load on the floors. And in both instances here, we have commercial structures that are selling retail, that we have coolers and other heavy furniture and devices that have been added onto these already inherently weakened floor that, you know, whether we add fire to it on the underside or impingement, there are a variety of factors here that our fire officers and our incident commanders just need to be more in tune with building performance as well as the company's performance in terms of the tactical assignments. It's a very delicate balance, and Joe, you and I have had some very robust discussions about that when we talk about Type 3 buildings, Main Street buildings, and you certainly have been a major advocate talking about this in many of your lectures around the country at FDIC and so forth. So, you know, let's just diverge a little bit. You know, we talked about the two events, and again, our listeners can go online to both the NIOSH and pull up both of these reports, as well as go to our website on firegroundleadership.com, which is part of Penwell's fireemsblog.com network, and take a look at some of the insights that we've provided here. But, you know, I think it's the important part here, and let's just focus in on this aspect here. From a company officer standpoint, I think we sort of set this into motion. In the Bronx, we had a lieutenant who's leading a newly probationary firefighter into a heavily involved basement fire. We have a building of type 3 construction. In Buffalo, we have, again, a building of type 3 construction, fire in the basement. We have a structure that has, in this instance, just age and deterioration, whereas the fire in on Walton Ave in the Bronx had unknown structural deficiencies, but both of them had the characteristic type 3 construction. So we have fire. We have suppression activities underway. We have commanding officers that are establishing the strategies, which are pretty straightforward in this event. But again, the tactical elements are straightforward, classical firefighting. Stretch the line, deploy our personnel for search and rescue. For our primary, we have our typical elements to deal with. And in both of these instances, from what we are now learning more, let's throw the whole aspect of the science and the streets portion of it. we have the fire dynamics. So, Joe, you made mention a little bit about the fire portion of it, and I'll just add this, and I'll let you provide some insights on this. But the one critical part when we talk about our buildings of Type 3 construction and our typical experiences within these structures, and this is something that is the common thread of everything that we're hearing from NIST and UL, and again, giving us causing us to have pause to start looking at this differently, is that the fire dynamics in the fire load package, the stuff that's in our buildings, the stuff that's within these particular occupancies and the compartments, is affecting the building components in a much more dramatic fashion, in a much more compressed time frame, which goes back to, Joe, your comment about the old 20-minute rule and the fact that we no longer really have an established time frame. Typically, many departments around the country will use a 10-minute PAR for both operational standpoint as a benchmark, but is that, I'll pose that open-ended question, is that adequate today for the urban or the suburban or the rural environment? And there are some factors here that say either yes or no. So what's your take on that part of it from a commanding officer and a company officer standpoint? Building performance, well, fire dynamics, and doing what we're supposed to do. Stretch the line, go in, do our search and rescue, put water on the fire, do what we need to be doing. So what's your take on that?
Well, I think the 10-minute, the thing that kind of gets me on the updates and the 10-minute rule was that you see a lot of departments that, okay, they had 20-minute rule. Then they said, well, no, buildings are collapsing and lightweight construction, we better go to 10. Well, that's not the point. The point is that look at this. The building in the Bronx was an old Type 3 legacy type of building. I don't remember off the top of my head. It was a Dollars type store when the fire occurred. But let's be real. In the 1920s and 30s, when these buildings were built, they were not dollar stores. They were, you know, whether some sort of commercial building, which didn't have the fuel package that these buildings today now have. But the mom-and-pop shoe store has moved out. 30 years later, it is now a dollar store or that typical type of store where there's countless items of plastics and everything that we're learning about from NIST in a building of Type 3 that is – you. So now you have the fire dynamics. So that is going to burn a lot, you know, the heat. And the fire is going to release the heat a lot quicker. And now you're pouring water on top of all this. Well, what is that doing? That's also compromising the building. So those three things, I think we have to look at the time isn't always about, well, 10 minutes lightweight, it's going to collapse. No, 10 minutes in all structures. But we have to look at what the use of that structure is. Is it a vacant, totally empty building? You know, in the Buffalo one, it was a store. And, yes, there was heavy refrigerators and all that. But in the Bronx case, you had tons and tons of stock. And you add that to the rotting rafters beneath. So it just is a recipe. And there's some things you just cannot avoid. But you cannot overlook the fact that as a company officer or a command officer that you constantly – hammer into your people, you need to look at these buildings. You need to develop a keen eye at what exactly you have and thoroughly dissect these buildings before there's a fire. And in the case of these Type 3 buildings, if it was once an auto repair shop and is now a dollar type store, which are very common in my area, and, you know, They sprout up everywhere, and that it's a different thing. It's a whole different animal because of the stock and because of the contents, and you really need to get in there and look. So I guess that's my take, that don't assume that the 10-minute thing stands for just lightweight construction, that, oh, those were because, you know, we're fighting fires in a lightweight. This doesn't apply. It's a Type 3. It's a building that's 100 years old. No, the time is still the time. It's just that your thoughts are a lot different, that you have to look at, again, the building and what's inside if you're making any progress.
A lot of
Chris,
too, Joe, you made mention. Sure, John.
Here. Hang on a second. Sorry about that. Yeah, listening, I love the 20-minute benchmarks and the 10-minute benchmarks. They're absolutely essential. In the case of basement fires, we have this new animal, this different animal, different from any of the other fires that we have. And if you look specifically at the Buffalo fire, at the NIOSH report in the Buffalo fire, you can see that not only was there was a huge delay in just gaining access to the fire, you know, and Joe, as we move forward, we'll play the 30-minute, you know, check, and then another audio we have from the fire. But, you know, I think instead of the 10-minute, 20-minute benchmarks, which are invaluable, like I say, we might want to also consider the importance that the first-arriving company officer or whoever's in charge of that interior attack needs to be able to communicate the environment that they've got based on what's going on, so the command can make an effective decision on whether to, you know, stay offensive or defensive. So I guess what I'm saying is it's really incumbent upon that company officer to constantly communicate. And that's tough to do when you're battling the beast right at its face. So, you know, in this case, 10 minutes or 20 minutes, you know, 30 minutes, I mean, they still haven't gained access to the fire, and it's a basement fire, you know. Decisions need to be made, and boy, I could tell you, I've been in there when you are that close to making a rescue, and you just need to continue to do it, and that's all that's on your mind. And again, the benchmarks are good, but really the communications between that company officer and the rest of the fire ground is absolutely critical.
Very much absolutely. So, John. You know, that's a great point when you talk about, regardless of organizational effectiveness or size and composition, career volunteer, it is so critical for our company officers as well as our firefighters. Again, we have the expanding proliferation of radios, whereas, you know, not too many years ago it would be certainly much more limiting in terms of the availability from companies. Now we're pretty much starting to see a trend where everyone is moving forward to having radio communications. The key part of that is being able to communicate, actually more important, it's being able to comprehend what you're either seeing, what you're feeling, what you're hearing, and what your gut is telling you internal within that compartment. So companies are inside, and there's some things that are very obvious based upon our training and experiences and what our experience gauges may give us. Company officers, again, hopefully based upon their experience on the job and within the environment, that they have developed a keen sense of indicators to understand what it is that they're getting sensory-wise and be able to communicate that concisely and effectively to the commanding officers, who also need to be able to filter and discern what it is that communication is telling them. The critical part of all of this goes back to three pieces, actually three or four. It's understanding that the elements of that building in terms of how that communication and the fire ground conditions are affecting the building. The other part of that is how is the fire dynamics and the factors affecting that compartment within the structure based upon the progression or development of fire and the products within that space that they may be in. And it's also, the other part of that is the competencies and skill sets and capabilities of the company. So those three pieces in our given buildings, as it relates back to the commander, helps gauge how long they may be able to stay in the structure. If I have a highly proficient and highly experienced set of companies that are operating within that building, and I may have potentially a very small margin or window to operate under, I may be able to do some very extraordinary things given a very delicate level of risk. However, on the opposite end, our listeners should also, you know, take a look at the retrospective item that you may have an inexperienced level of companies or a varying level of experience from various companies that are deployed and operating who may not have that same skill set level, which now combining with building performance, fire dynamics, and again, the bad things that can happen in our fire load packages within our compartments, coupled with the factors of the company, creates an entirely different set of PAR parameters and watching that time clock from the incident commander standpoint. I may be able to do some very effective things with a highly disciplined, highly effective company at a 10-minute mark or 15-minute mark, but I may be backing out with an entirely different set of parameters with companies that may not be as effective and efficient at a 5-minute mark because conditions and factors may change dramatically. So with that being said, you know, it's just a very delicate balance. And when we get into these benchmarkings, and if we don't take into account our company-level capabilities, whether it be at the station level, departmental, battalion, division, what have you, mutual aid. I mean, again, you may have a very highly effective department, but how is that impacted during daytime hours when you have automatic or mutual aid coming in and your neighboring department or, you know, your hop, skip, and jump department that's coming from a greater distance on that greater alarm may not have that same skill set. Then your fire ground factors are all going to be much more variable from that standpoint. So with that, John, let's take this is a good time for a break. John, let's take us to break, and this is Taking It to the Streets. I'm your host, Chris Naum. I'm with Joe Pernesti and John Mitchell, and we are talking about a variety of elements dealing with two specific line of duty death studies, both at New York State, Buffalo, New York, and FDNY in the Bronx. And we'll be right back after this short break and to continue our lessons from the fire ground.
You know that buildingsonfire.com has a vast series of exceptional e-media offerings that include FireGroundLeadership.com, TheFireOfficer.com, Buildings on Fire on Facebook, as well as Twitter. Check out these premier websites. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and get engaged to meet the operational demands of today's evolving fire service, integrating the art and science of firefighting for operational excellence and firefighter safety.
Life is complicated, but your education shouldn't be. At Columbia Southern University, we'll make sure of it.
We offer quality online programs, low-cost tuition, textbooks at no cost, and caring faculty and staff to help ease the transition of going back to school. We'll be here to support you every step of the way, from application to graduation.
We also offer financial savings through our scholarship opportunities and learning partnership programs.
Your success is our success.
So join the CSU family, and together we can achieve your dreams.
Hi, this is Tiger Schmittendorf, Chief Storyteller at RunToTheCurb.com, inviting you to listen in to Firefighter Storytellers on the Firefighter Netcast Radio Network. Run to the Curb, tell your story.
Taking It to the Streets is all about advancing firefighter safety and operational integrity for the fire service through provocative insights and dynamic discussions dedicated to both the art and science of firefighting and the traditions of the fire service. The focus at Taking It to the Street continues to be straightforward, street-level talk with intelligent, stimulating, and provocative insights and dynamic discussion with interactive dialogue and, most importantly, listener participation. Just like around the kitchen table or in the day room over a cup of coffee at 0230 after a good run. And now, the latest edition of Taking It to the Streets with your host, Christopher Naum.
Program, we're talking about Buffalo, Bronx, and basement ops, specifically remembering two line of duty death events, both double line of duty events, one which occurred in Buffalo, New York on August 24th, 2009, and our second event which occurred on August 27th, 2006 in FDNY. And again, I'm joined on this edition of Taking the Streets with Joe Pernesti and John Mitchell. So during the first half of our program, we talked about both events, talked a little bit about the parameters of the building, the fireground conditions, both in Buffalo and in the Bronx. and the commonalities that, again, these particular events and incidences and the building types have to our listeners, again, regardless of whether we are discussing them in the urban context or certainly in their applications within the suburban or certainly in the rural settings. Any department that's running with a small contingent of firefighters and a volunteer station that, again, very likely will have a very similar structure, standalone structure, or maybe part of your Main Street area within your particular community. So these particular lessons from the fireground certainly are not just restricted to the urban environments in which the occurrences happened, but again, the learnings that one may take that each and every one of our listeners should take, both in terms of the information from the NIOSH reports as well as our dialogue and our very extensive supplementary information that we have. So, again, our listeners are reminded that on our firegroundleadership.com site, we did have a very lengthy conversation, both a podcast back in February and a variety of supportive information. Our most recent posting for the Buffalo, New York, Genesee Street fire that we're referring to is online for you to take a look at, but I'll also have our listeners go again to the Penwell Fire EMS blog.com site, of which we are a very proud participants with Penwell's family for firegroundleadership.com, and go to our postings from February, in which we have again a variety of media downloads, some insights on basement fires, some information and takeaways, both in terms of some PDF downloads, a conversation on basement fires that were part of our podcast, as well as a variety of other informational items dealing with upwards of about 12 to 15 line-of-duty deaths that have occurred over the last 15-year period. That includes both Buffalo's line-of-duty death, Coleraine Township, a variety of different events in Kentucky, the most recent events in San Francisco, Georgia, as well as New York City. So the continuing issues with line-of-duty deaths, challenges on the fire ground with basement fires, but more importantly, our discussion here on this edition of Taking to the Streets dealing with Type 3 buildings. So let me say this. Let me turn this back over to Joe and John. You add in accordingly. So we've talked about the parameters that dealt with benchmarking and our 10-minute or 15-minute, 20-minute PARs and benchmarkings of operations. Joe, take us into some of the initiating events just as the May Day event occurred in Buffalo, and we have a couple of sound bites here to support that discussion. So I'll turn that back over to you, Joe.
Okay. Well, 20 minutes in, they had the line stretched, and Lieutenant Chip McCarthy. Now, again, I want to remind our listeners, we're not casting any doubt or any negativity on the operations there. This is just one event that I feel that it can happen in any city, big or small, and they just offer excellent lessons and study. So it's not being critical. Those command officers, I couldn't carry their lunch budget. They're experienced. They go to more fires than most cities. A very, very good fire department. But on this particular fire, back to it, they have the lines laid in, and at the 30-minute mark, there still hasn't been a mayday. There still isn't anything unusual going on. Chip McCarthy from the rescue company, Rescue One, they were first assigned to the second floor to search. They did that. They had negative findings, negative as far as victims. They reported that. They came down, and then McCarthy went in on the first floor then to see about seeing where this fire is at because the conditions were deteriorating on the first floor. And I'll let John play. This is a 30. Okay, so McCarthy and Rescue One are going into the first floor. The conditions are deteriorating. They still haven't gotten much water, if at all, on the seat of the fire. Very difficult to access the fire. And then this is the 30-minute clip. Go ahead, John.
Down there. Also be advised, report some conditions on the first floor. They're starting to deteriorate. 22, Command, did you just say conditions are deteriorating on the first floor?
Command, that came from B-43 reporting conditions are deteriorating on the first floor. You're 30 minutes into the incident also.
Okay, 30 minutes into 1815 on Genesee Street. Still continuing to operate all hands. We'll continue to hold the second alarm.
Copy that.
14 portable, Command. Yeah, how did you make out with that door, 14?
Okay, so 30 minutes in. They're still trying to get to this fire. Conditions are deteriorating. And then pretty much shortly thereafter, the Mayday occurred. And before I have John play that Mayday clip, I want everybody, especially command officers, you know, Chris made excellent points. You made excellent points on company officers and their effectiveness. Command officers today, they cannot command fires like it's in the 90s. And they have to be so on top of their game and take everything in. Things have changed so much in our profession that the art of commanding and control is so much more difficult, and there's so many more things to think about. And, again, this is why this particular fire event should be mandatory study by all command officers. So at this point, McCarthy falls through the floor, and he gives out a Mayday. One of the problems they had was that his radio was on a talk around and not on a repeater. And quickly, basically what that means is it was just radio to radio. They could hear him, not very clearly, but only certain people that were close to him could make out. And so that added to the problem because his button had pushed on his radio, depressed, and it was on a talk around. So he has gone through the floor. He's given out a Mayday, and I'll let John play the clip of the Mayday.
14 to command. Was that a Mayday transmission? Command, Rescue 1, someone screaming in the basement. Rescue 1, I believe I hear screaming in the front of the basement, number 1 side. What's your location? Who's calling, Command? What's your location? Dispatch 4-3, who's yelling? Location! 4-3, Command, I'm going to make you the rescue chief. You've got Ladder 7 as your staff team.
Okay, John, you can cut it there. Okay, so McCarthy has gone through the floor. His other company members... That Rescue 1 you heard on there was another company member that he could hear yelling. That was McCarthy calling for help, they believe. And so now they've launched a Mayday. They followed their protocol. The one thing about Buffalo that they are ahead of the game as far as, and I recommend to everybody listening that on these buildings also, and this would be another podcast, Chris, that as far as getting command-level officers on the scene and getting them in proper positions around the building or on the roof or whatever is vitally important. And at this fire, they had, at this time, I believe they had two battalion chiefs on the scene and the shift commander in command. So they had three chief officers on the scene, I believe, minimum at this time. And so he was able to get things going as far as having a chief run the Mayday and another run the fire or so on. So they did in their procedures what they were told. So McCarthy's in the basement. They activated the FAST team. And, we're not really doing this justice. Again, go to Chris's this is the site and look this up as far as the entire entire story. I encourage you, everyone listening, to do that. But at this point, they've activated the FAST team, as they call it, and that they went in to try to locate McCarthy. Crews, at that time, the firefighter crew knew where McCarthy, he had a good idea where McCarthy was at because he saw him inside the first floor. He went in, he went in to try to find him and did not, there wasn't very good communication between him and his officer. And McCarthy, and then Kroom fell through the hole on top of McCarthy. And so now they're both down in the basement. But command did not know that Kroom did this. He did not notify anybody he had done this, I don't believe. There was just some chaotic moments where his accountability, he wasn't accounted for, and they did not know that he was trapped also, that Kroom now is down, that he had fallen through. And they took what's called they don't call them a PAR, they called an emergency head count. The command was starting to get reports, you know, they wanted them to see who was down in the basement. They weren't sure that McCarthy was the one that was down. Followed his protocol, their SOPs. He took what's called an emergency head count. I'll let John play the emergency head count now. Go ahead, John.
Dispatch 4-3, Channel 2. Fire dispatch, 4-3, Channel 2.
4-3, go.
I need an emergency head count. I got to find out who's down there.
Roger.
Companies, right now.
Emergency head count for 1815 Genesee Street. Engine 31 status.
Good.
31 status.
All accounted.
Engine 22 status. Engine 22 status.
22 is all for.
Engine 23 status. Engine 23 status.
23 all accounted for.
Letter 14 status. Letter 14 status.
All okay.
Letter 6 status. Letter 6 your status.
All accounted for.
Letter 7 status.
Letter 7 okay.
Rescue 1 status. Rescue 1.
Missing Lieutenant McCarthy.
Roger.
Okay, Johnny, cut it.
I need
They went ahead with this head count. You can hear them say they're McCarthy, so they know now they're looking for Lieutenant Chip McCarthy. But if you heard, he called Ladder 7, and that was Kroom's company. His company officer said that he had everybody. There were some mix-ups on his crew as far as some overtime issues and who was working for who. Not going to go into great detail, but the bottom line was there was two emergency headcounts conducted where Kroom's officer told command that he had his people. And it turned out that he did not. They did not have accountability. And Kroom was in the basement. It shows that, and everyone listening, if you heard the stress in that dispatcher's voice, that's what I mentioned. Are your dispatchers in your communication center prepared to handle these maydays? Are they? She did very well, but you could hear the emotion in her voice. How well will your dispatch center operate in a mayday? You know, these are all things that you have got to find. And if you're in command, you can't wait at 3 in the morning and get upset and be moaning and groaning about your command center for, you know, for the last 5 years, and then at 3 o'clock in the morning have to do this and have issues. All these things added up. All these things came together at this fire, Chris, and there are just several good points that, again, this is why I think every command officer needs to review this fire, and Chief should play that emergency head count to their command centers.
Well, and again, you know, the dynamics of the fire ground, and Joe, all of us, John, Joe, you know, the three of us know very well, based upon our years on the job, what can go wrong in a heartbeat on the fire ground. Dynamics on the fire ground may dramatically change and be affected by a variety of factors and such. So certainly with what we heard and certainly with what transpired in Buffalo on Genesee Street has occurred in other jurisdictions and other near misses and other line of duty deaths. So certainly we are providing some insights here and just exploring some of these pieces in the highest level of honor and reverence to the job of what all of the firefighters and officers in Buffalo committed to doing at that time of the event. But again, the resonating aspects here are this, and clearly the takeaway is that there's a cooperative effort amongst all of our related systems. And we talk about the fire ground as one of our systems, and we certainly focus in upon that as commanding officers, as company officers, as firefighters. But the extended part of that system includes the call takers and the dispatchers and as well as our fire ground communicators in the dispatch centers who can either help facilitate and filter out information, who also have important roles that provide support and a direct link back to an evolving operation. So the sound bites that we had the opportunity to listen to that we've put into our program here are meant to help identify elements that hopefully can allow for further improvements and build upon the lessons from the tragic events in Buffalo and the ultimate sacrifice that both Jonathan Kroom and Lieutenant Charles Chip McCarthy epitomized from the fire service standpoint. So I'll say this too. Let me add this other part here that I think is important for our listeners. So we've, again, just to come back to center, two similar types of occupancies, two very similar sized buildings, very common in terms of the similarities in terms of the Type 3 or Class 3 brick and joist ordinary construction. One, in Buffalo, we have a floor compromise that results in a fall through of a firefighter from the number one floor into the basement within a 30-minute duration of time from arrival and initial operations. In the Bronx, for our event in which, again, Lieutenant Howard Karpluck and firefighter Michael Riley were subsequently operating in, again, we have a floor that compromises and collapses into a V-shaped collapse based upon a girder, a single girder that was supporting that particular floor in which those firefighters as well as actually upwards of six additional firefighters were operating. So we have both the lieutenant and the firefighter operating in that vicinity as well as four other firefighters, which included a lieutenant, two other firefighters, and a battalion chief. So we in the Bronx, we actually had six individuals operating within the interior compartment on the number one floor in between vertical metal shelving with products, working their way back to what would be considered the number three side of the structure toward the refrigeration units that were back there. So we end up having a collapse that actually occurs within the 15-minute duration or benchmark of our operation. So Buffalo, 30 minutes of operation. We talk about predictability of performance and building and components, assemblies, and systems. And we have a failure point, which occurs, again, based upon a variety of other parameters in the Bronx within the 15-minute duration of time, which is typically what? We're just deploying our lines. We're getting a feel for forcible entry, reading the smoke, reading the conditions. We're deploying. We're working in a very efficient fashion to do what everyone has been advocating to do, stretch the line, get water on the seat of the fire. Again, and what Andy Fredericks was so good at telling us and advocating in his day was, again, if we put water on the fire, what happens, guys? All the other problems get better and get minimized. But, again, we have engine company deployment. They're stretching a 2.5-inch line based upon the fire condition, based upon their operating procedures. But, again, just the point here for our listeners is that one 30 minutes, the other 15-minute duration time. So it's so important to maintain a very fluid sense of situational awareness, which sometimes it's a is a much overused term, but does have a variety of connotations when we talk about the adaptiveness on today's fire ground that is really necessary. But again, deployment of our companies, working within our structures, our job is what it is, and that is to address the conditions upon our arrival as a responding fire suppression organization. We are the fire department, so we respond, we deploy based upon the factors that are given to us. Buffalo, we have factors that are beyond our control, but communications and dispatch, call takers are getting information, they're feeding it to the field companies are responding, and we are taking that into our account based upon our fire ground operations. And we develop our strategies, we deploy our tactics, and we do what is given to us. So, you know, there's no clear answers. And certainly for our listeners that are out there, I will go back to the aspect of understanding your buildings. You know, and in this particular installment, we're talking about the Type 3 Main Street structures or brick and joist buildings, which can certainly be related to about every one of our listeners that are out there. Understanding the dynamics within the structures, and certainly understanding even more so the limitations and the capabilities of your role on the fire ground, whether you are a firefighter, whether you are a company officer, or a commanding officer. There are distinctively different sets of skill sets that are demanded of you. And we take a look at the honor and sacrifice of these two events, and we take a look at all of the factors of the close calls, the of the survivors, the deployment of our FAST companies and RIT teams, and the management of that incident, as well as, again, the deployment of all of the other supportive companies to conduct the rescue efforts as those May Days went out. Again, I would encourage our listeners to take a look at, spend some time with both of the NIOSH reports, as well as the Buffalo's internal report on the third alarm fire at 1815 Genesee Street, which we do have the link available to our listeners on the firegroundleadership.com site for our latest postings. We would encourage our listeners to take the time to read more specifically the details of both of these particular events and glean through them specifics dealing with the tactical operations, the building factors. There's much more detailed information in the Buffalo Line of Duty Death Report that gives you some further insights on the building in particular, which, again, when we talk about understanding building construction, there's some very, very good lessons to be learned. And certainly looking at it from a tactical standpoint where we have multiple May Days occurring simultaneously, and more importantly, the demands that now are in need of being rapidly deployed for the extrication, for the identification of the location. So locating and then determining the extrication methods for the prompt and rapid removal of those individuals, of our firefighters that have now become trapped due to the collapsing conditions. So we don't just have two firefighters missing as we did in Buffalo, but in the Bronx for our event here that we're discussing for the Walton Ave event, we had six personnel that are all in a May Day situation, which, again, initially are unknown in terms of their condition and the susceptibility that they may have to the compartment. So the other part of that is the timeliness of our RIT deployments and FAST teams and capabilities, which certainly, Joe, you and I will leave for another days of discussion. John, what's your take on some of the elements there from Chicagoland? Obviously, being in the Chicago metro area, Chicago and certainly the outlying suburban departments are no strangers to basement fires in Chicago's rich tradition. Any take or feedback on some things that are occurring out in your area?
No, other than the fact that, you know, UL is out here constantly looking at a lot of the incidents that are occurring and drawing from that some great data that we can put forth as we move toward battling these basement fires. You know, a lot of the basement fires that, you know, Joe, you may have in Ohio, Chris out in New York, for many of you. Anywhere you have a basement fire, we have these just horrible conditions for firefighters. It's been said that more firefighters have died in what they call subdivision fires, where they're below the grade, than have occurred at first floor or above, and there's good reason. And one thing I'd like to say, Chris, is that it's important for us to honor these firefighters that have gone before us and their departments who continue to suffer. You know, I'm sure Buffalo realizes the date, and New York as well. I don't know if you said at the top of the at the program, but these two line of duty death fires, these double line of duty death fires, occurred August 24th and August 27th. So, you know, I appreciate what you're doing on your end in bringing to the surface the things that we can learn, at least learn from what they've done, and be able to keep them in the back of our mind. We should do this for every anniversary of every line of duty death fire. We can learn so much from that, and I applaud you and Joe for applying this manner of, I call it instruction, having been a training officer myself, but you know, you could take this program and use it in your department at any time for training. And these are timely events. They'll be talked about. And like I said, we are in a position where we need to learn from them, and that's how we honor their lives. So Chris and Joe, thank you so much for bringing this, this type of format for a podcast listening for the firefighters to be able to participate in that celebration.
John, you make some great points on UL, certainly in the Chicagoland area. And again, for our listeners, I'll direct them back to firegroundleadership.com, our most recent posting from this past Monday on August 24th. Again, we do have some links that are tied back into UL's knowledge services, some items on fire dynamics of basements. Our listeners should recall that there has been some significant strides that UL has conducted based upon some previous research and modeling specific to basement fires. And again, I would encourage our listeners to go to ulknowledgeservices.com, take a look at some elements on basement dynamics. Again, the continuing dialogue dealing with flow paths, the challenges on tactical deployment, what may have been certainly an acceptable level of operation in the past, are being challenged, and those paradigms are being challenged each and every day. And they well should be, because, again, our buildings are changing, our fire load packages, the building's behavior, the fire's behavior, and we have to certainly be more adaptable to our fire ground tactics in order for us to do our jobs more effectively, for us to be able to survive, and also to provide a life-sustaining capability to our civilians and to the citizens that we serve should they become distressed or in a position of incapacitation within the structure. So a lot of good information for our listeners back on the website that we will link you in for some further insights. Now, we haven't talked about engineered floor systems. We haven't talked about tactical issues dealing with flow paths and all of the other fire dynamics. Our program for this installment of Taking It to the Streets primarily was to provide some insights on two specific events which occurred within a very timely time frame of each other regarding the anniversary dates. Our August 24th, 2009 event in Buffalo, New York, and then also our line of duty, double line of duty death on August 27th, which is approaching here within a day or two, 2006, with our event in FDNY. So again, it's important for us to understand the sacrifice, understand the honor, the courage, the level of protection afforded by those two respective departments, Buffalo, New York, and FDNY, the fortitude of our firefighters that was evident that as you read those reports and as we've talked about on this installment, and more importantly, the duty of all of us to our brother firefighters who paid the ultimate sacrifice, to our brother firefighters who operated on those particular scenes, and again, whose lessons and elements resonate certainly in a variety, in a much different context than what we are talking about here. It's part of our job, and we have a little we have a little item on our website that says this. It's not something you do, it's something you are, and we understand that when we talk about our job of firefighting. So, again, we certainly hope that we've conveyed our level of appreciation for our brother firefighters in both cities and departments. We honor the sacrifices that our brothers have given for the citizens of both communities, and we, the fire service, with every attempt to learn from these sacrifices, which is the entire intent and objective here of our program tonight. So, Joe, what other takeaways do we have here to give our listeners as we start wrapping up our program?
Well, I think we touched on just, I don't want to overload everybody tonight, but we hit so many things that I think the biggest thing is this. If you're a command officer or a company officer, it's the same thing. You need to get out into your buildings, number one. Number two, you have to be and train yourself to be able to put the pieces together. And sometimes that's difficult. And you got to be able to put the pieces together under duress and under a stressful situation. And the better you are doing that, the better command officer you are. And you can only do that by practice and by study. Also, with line-of-duty death reports, you know, we live in a world on social media where you can get on and bash everybody, and I get so sick of, I don't even look at them anymore, the Facebook sites where, you know, they're inside, outside debate. It's a waste of time and brain cells to go back to debate back and forth. But I will say this, when it comes to line of duty death reports, you must read every single one that comes down the line, and especially those that have to deal with firefighters that are dying in structure fires or collapse or fire behavior events, because each one is different. I cringe when I hear people, whether it's in my department or anywhere else, say, well, you've read one, you've read them all. Well, no, that's not the case, and tonight's a great example of two distinct fires happening in the same type of building, type 3, but each had different issues. And so you can't just say, well, I've read one, I've read them all. You're doing a disservice to yourself and, most importantly, to the people you lead and work with. So you got to get out there as a company officer and get into these reports and read them. And you know what? If they're boring, then go to Chris's site, and he makes great, great graphics and pictures, and they're quick. And you get the gist, and you learn a lot from the website. So that's about all I have on this, and I'm sure we can keep going on them. But that's my 2 cents for tonight.
John, any other closing comments on your end?
No, thanks again, Chris. Very enlightening, and I'm looking forward to following up on more of the what we can learn from what's happened out there. And as your show says, take it to the streets. And that's where the firefighters come in. That's, take this information, take it to the streets, take it with you out there, and use it as it was meant to be used. So thank you again, Chris.
And thank you to our listeners that are listening live. We did not take into account any call-ins tonight just based upon our time frame and some of the specifics. We always encourage any feedback. We certainly thank you for listening in. And we hope to that your investment of time to listen in on our program has will give you the right support going forward in your particular jobs. Again, we must maintain and have the highest level of fortitude and courage to be both safety conscious and measured in our performance of our sworn duties, while maintaining the appropriate balance of risk and bravery in what each and every one of our departments, our organizations, and each and every one of ourselves do every time we go on shift or we turn out to respond to an alarm. So, again, this program is dedicated in the honor and remembrance of Buffalo, New York, Fire Department Lieutenant Charles Chip McCarthy, and Buffalo, New York, Firefighter Jonathan Kroom, and Lieutenant FDNY Howard Karpluck, and FDNY Firefighter Michael Riley for their sacrifice to our profession and to the citizens that they were sworn to protect. One other note for our international listeners, this sort of came about indirectly, but today is actually the 43rd anniversary in the Scottish Fire and Rescue Services of a line of duty death event that occurred on August 25th, in 1972. And this is referred to as the Kilburny Street fire, in which six firefighters lost their lives during the course of operations at a warehouse event. One firefighter was missing, and the subsequent five firefighters who went in to render aid to find that firefighter, trapped firefighter, and attempt to bring him out were caught up in a flashover event. And this was in the Glasgow Fire Services, and we hope to get some more insights on that and get some information posted. But again, just remembrance for our U.S. brothers as well as our international fire service brothers. So with that, until next time, companies are in quarters and off the air. Stay safe, but keep in mind there's a job being worked somewhere in the streets, in your city, across the country, and around the world, doing what we do best and being who we are. And that's firefighters. Until next time, take care, everyone.